Hello, and welcome back to Jacko's Stackology, where we talk about concepts in neuroscience and psychology. This is the third part of my clinical neuroanatomy series. Today, we're going to be talking about signaling in the nervous system. Over the last couple of episodes, we've talked a lot about the neuron, which is a specialized cell of the nervous system, and how there are all types of different neurons, and they have varying functions. As I mentioned in the last episode, we likely will be talking about neurons all throughout this series. So, not to be too redundant, but a lot of this information can be pretty complicated, and I think it would be good to revisit it pretty regularly. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. First off, nerves communicate with one another, and like muscle cells, they are excitable, which means that they respond to stimuli by generating electrical signals. The modification of a neuron's electrical potential can be either local or propagated. If it's local, it's restricted to the area of the neuron that receives the signal. If it's propagated, it's able to travel through the neuron and down its axon. That signal will then be relayed down the axon and eventually out to another neuron. We call these propagated signals action potentials. Sometimes you'll hear me refer to them simply as APs. Neurons use a process called synaptic transmission to communicate with one another at the synapse, which is that junction where they meet. One of the more important concepts in understanding how the nervous system works is understanding membrane potential, or another way to think about it is the voltage that's going across the membrane. The neuron is a cell, and it has an internal environment and an external environment. The internal environment I'll refer to as intracellular, and the external environment is extracellular. They both have an electric charge, but the charge between the intracellular and the external environment is different, and this difference is the membrane potential. So when we're talking about membrane potential, we're talking about the difference in charge between the intracellular environment and the extracellular environment. This results in the cell maintaining a resting potential of around negative 70 millivolts across the cell membrane, which is equivalent to 71 thousandths of a volt. And we'll talk about why that is in just a moment. I'm going to try to go pretty slow through this stuff because it can get a little bit complicated. We're going to talk about some equations, and we're going to talk about what it means when we're measuring electrical activity and conduction across the neural membrane. So this electrical potential exists across the membrane because of its selective permeability to charged ions. The membrane of a neuron is very permeable by most inorganic ions. However, proteins and many organic ions cannot pass through it. The difference in the ionic concentration inside and outside of the cell produces a gradient, which is maintained by ion pumps in the membrane, which supply a constant concentration of inorganic ions within the cell. So for those of you who don't know what a gradient occurs when there is a difference in concentrations of something. It could be a substance. In this case, when we are referring to a gradient, we're talking about the property in which ions are at a different concentration in one area to another, and they will naturally want to flow from the place of higher concentration to the place of lower concentration, so that they eventually balance out. The sodium-potassium pump is a protein that uses ATPase function to move sodium from the inside of the cell out to the external or the extracellular environment and imports potassium ions from the extracellular environment into the intracellular environment. So I used the term ATPase function, and what I mean by that is that there is a little molecule by the name of adenosine triphosphate, abbreviated ATP. And an adenosine triphosphate is named so because it is a molecule of adenosine which has three attached phosphates, hence the name triphosphate, right? So you have an adenosine group and then three phosphate groups all attached, making one molecule. And what is particularly handy about this little molecule is that it is ready to remove one of its phosphate groups at any given time. So when that happens, the triphosphate then becomes a diphosphate, right? Because then it's two phosphates instead of three. So ATP will lose a phosphate to become ADP. And then ADP is also readily able to absorb another phosphate group, and it will turn back to ATP. And the act of losing a phosphate group and gaining a phosphate group means that this helpful little molecule can change the conformation of other proteins throughout the membrane. So when I say that the sodium-potassium pump is a protein in the membrane, and it uses this function, this ATPase function, what I mean is we start off with a protein of a particular configuration, and when an adenosine triphosphate molecule comes into contact, the sodium-potassium pump will take the phosphate off of the ATP. The ATP will then go on to become an ADP. The sodium-potassium pump that has taken the phosphate on will then change its conformation such that it takes some of the sodium from the inside of the cell and pushes it out of the cell. And the act of it releasing sodium will change its conformation such that the protein will now actively seek to remove its phosphate that it had accumulated. An ADP will come by and pick that phosphate group back up to become an ATP once again. And when it does so, the sodium-potassium pump reconfigures once again, but this time pulling some potassium from the extracellular environment back into the intracellular environment. And when it does so, it changes its conformity once again so that it will readily accept another phosphate from another ATP. So here we have a really important concept in all of cellular science, which is that proteins and molecules change their configuration depending on how they interact with other molecules. The sodium-potassium pump starts off ready to absorb sodium, and when it does so, an ATP comes by and releases a phosphate, and in doing so, reconfigures that protein to release the sodium out of the cell. And by releasing the sodium out of the cell, the protein reconfigures to readily take in potassium from the extracellular environment. And once it has done so, it reconfigures again so that it can release the phosphate group that it had gained, and thereby reconfiguring in such a way as to push the potassium back into the cell and restart the cycle. The way that the sodium-potassium pump functions is to push two sodium ions out for every three potassium ions it receives into the cell. Sodium is a positively charged ion, and potassium is also a positively charged ion. Each of these ions have a net positive charge of one. So, the function of the sodium-potassium pump is to pump three sodium out for every two potassium in. So, every time this pump is activated and goes through one full cycle, it has lost three positive charges and gained two positive charges back. The loss of three and the gaining of two leads to a net one negative charge. This is the action that maintains the intracellular negativity when the cell is at rest. So we have two passive forces that maintain an equilibrium of sodium and potassium across the membrane. The first force is chemical, and that moves sodium inward and potassium outward from the compartment containing high concentration to the compartment containing low concentration. There's also an electrical force, which we refer to as the membrane gradient, that tends to move sodium and potassium both inward because of the net negative charge of the cell at rest. So let's talk about three main ions that will come up pretty often throughout this course. The two that you keep hearing me talk about are sodium and potassium, but the third one that we're going to talk about is chloride. Sodium is abbreviated Na and then a plus sign to indicate that it has a net one positive charge. Potassium is abbreviated K with a plus sign to indicate a net positive one charge. And chloride is abbreviated Cl with a negative charge, indicating that it has a negative one net charge. And inside of the cell, you will not find very much sodium. Most sodium is outside of the cell. And for potassium, you'll find a lot of potassium inside of the cell and not very much outside of the cell. This is because of the action of the sodium-potassium pump that I had just described. So you have a chemical gradient for sodium that is trying to actively push sodium into the cell because it's at a much higher concentration on the outside of the cell. So this chemical gradient is pushing sodium into the cell. And for potassium, you have a chemical gradient trying to push the potassium out of the cell because it's at a higher concentration inside of the cell. So keep in mind we're talking about two gradients here. So the chemical gradient is trying to push the ions from the place of most concentration to the place of least concentration. And then we have chloride, which is negatively charged, and it is present at a higher concentration on the outside of the cell than it is on the inside of the cell. So chloride will actively try to move into the cell based on this chemical gradient. As for the electrical gradient, remember that we're talking about charge, and because of the sodium-potassium pump, at rest, the cell is at a negative 70 millivolt charge, just about. And so, because opposites attract, any positive ion will have an electrical gradient pushing it towards the inside of the cell, and any negative ion will have an electric gradient pushing it out of the cell. Because of this, we have sodium trying to get into the cell, both because of the gradient that is chemical and the gradient that is electrical. You have potassium that is trying to get into the cell because of its electrical gradient, but also there are forces pushing it out of the cell because of its chemical gradient. And then you have chloride, which has forces pushing it into the cell because of its chemical gradient, but electrical forces are acting to push it out of the cell. I know this stuff gets really confusing. As we talk about these more, they start to make a little bit better sense. And now we have to talk about another very important concept in neuroscience, which is that when the chemical and electrical forces become equally strong, they create what we call an equilibrium potential. So, an equilibrium potential is the voltage that the membrane is at, given that the chemical and the electrical forces are equally strong. And to determine the equilibrium potential, we can start off with an equation called the Nernst equation. So, the Nernst equation is used to calculate this equilibrium potential for an idealized cell membrane that is only permeable to potassium ions. So, we are making the assumption that we have a membrane that can only allow potassium to pass through it, and we're trying to calculate where that membrane would be at equilibrium, meaning that its electrical and chemical forces would be equivalent. So, normally the inside of the cell has a much higher concentration of potassium than the outside of the cell. The Nernst equation is used to determine the membrane potential across the membrane as follows. First, you take the quantity of the gas constant and multiply it by temperature. You're taking a gas constant because you are assuming that the membrane is permeable to potassium the same way that gas flows. And you're multiplying that by temperature because the higher the temperature is, the faster that gas can move across the membrane. And that sounds way more complicated than it actually is, and we'll simplify that here in a moment. But you're going to take this quantity, the gas constant, and multiply it by temperature, and then you're going to take that product and divide it by the valence multiplied by the Faraday constant. I won't get too deep into why we're doing this, except that you can probably Google the answer and get it pretty quickly. But this is just some basic principles in cellular science that we're applying. So we've taken the gas constant times the temperature divided by the valence times the Faraday constant, and we then multiply that times the natural log of the external concentration of potassium ions divided by the internal concentration of potassium ions. And that will give you the voltage of the membrane at equilibrium potential for a membrane that is only permeable to potassium. And for physiologic temperatures, the initial proportion of the gas constant multiplied by temperature, then divided by the valence multiplied by the Faraday constant, will usually calculate out to be 58. So you can actually just substitute 58 for the first part of that equation, which means that you can multiply 58 times the natural log of the external potassium ions divided by the internal potassium ions. And that will give you the membrane potential for a membrane that is only permeable to potassium. That was a lot of math, but it's going to make sense in a second why we need to understand where equilibrium potentials are, because it actually helps us to predict how cells will fire. If you want to calculate the equilibrium potential for sodium, all you have to do is replace all the numbers that you have for potassium with sodium. That will give you the equilibrium potential for a membrane that is only permeable to sodium. And you can also do this for chloride, as well as other ions. So this leads us to another really important equation, known as the constant field equation. So most membranes are not permeable to just one ion. They're instead permeable to several ions, and so we require a weighted average of the equilibrium potentials for each permeable ion. This is because the membrane will be permeable to each ion at different rates. So using the constant field equation, we are actually able to look at the contribution of each ionic gradient and weight each one to reflect its contribution to the total membrane potential. We'll start with the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, which describes a membrane that is permeable to both sodium and potassium. So to get the membrane voltage using this equation, you take 58 multiplied by the natural log. Remember, we got 58 from the equation before. Multiplied by the natural log of the quantity of the membrane permeability of potassium ions multiplied by external concentration of potassium ions, plus the membrane permeability of sodium ions multiplied by the external concentration of sodium ions, and divide that all by the quantity of the membrane permeability to potassium multiplied by the internal concentration of potassium ions plus the membrane permeability to sodium multiplied by the concentration of internal sodium ions. So it's basically the same equation, but a little more complicated in that we are weighting the different contributions from both sodium and potassium. And in this same way, you can add the weights of pretty much any ions you would like. But in calculating the equilibrium potential for sodium, you will find that sodium reaches equilibrium at approximately positive 60 millivolts. The equilibrium potential for potassium is around negative 90 millivolts, and the equilibrium potential for chloride is around negative 70 millivolts. And in a moment, we'll talk about why those numbers are important. But first, let's talk about relative permeability. Relative permeability to each ion affects the membrane potential of a neuron. If a certain ion permeability increases, such as by opening pores or channels specifically permeable to that ion, the membrane potential moves closer to the equilibrium potential for that ion. If a certain ion permeability decreases, such as by closing pores or channels specifically permeable to that ion, the membrane potential moves away from the equilibrium potential for that ion. So, at rest, potassium permeability in the membrane is much higher than sodium permeability, a ratio of about 20 to 1. When the neuron is resting, the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation is dominated by potassium permeability so that the membrane potential is closer to the equilibrium potential for potassium, which accounts for the resting potential of approximately negative 70 millivolts. Remember that I had just mentioned that the resting potential for potassium is close to negative 90 millivolts. So this is saying we are trying to head towards negative 90 millivolts, but because of the positive charge of the sodium, we're only bottoming out at around negative 70 millivolts. But we are closer to the equilibrium potential for potassium than we are for sodium because the membrane permeability to potassium is much higher than it is for sodium when the neuron is at rest. Let's talk about generator potentials. The generator potential, or receptor potential, is a local, non-propagated response that occurs in some sensory receptors where mechanical energy is converted into electric signals. Some examples include muscle stretch receptors and touch pressure receptors. In the sensory cell, the generator potential is produced by the non-myelinated terminal. Most generator potentials are depolarizations, making the membrane potential less negative. Unlike action potentials, which are an all-or-none response, generator potentials are graded, meaning that a larger stimulus will lead to a larger depolarization. These are also additive, meaning that two small stimuli that occur close together in time produce a generator potential that is larger than that made by a single small stimulus. Further increase in stimulation results in larger generator potentials. When the magnitude of the generator potential increases to about 10 millivolts, a propagated action potential, or an impulse, or sometimes we'll call it a spike, is generated in the sensory nerve. All right. So what are action potentials, right? Or these spikes, or these impulses? So neurons communicate to one another using action potentials, which are all-or-none responses. These APs are self-generated electrical signals that tend to propagate down the axon of a neuron. An AP is a depolarization of about 100 millivolts, and its size is constant for each neuron. These are called spikes because they look like spikes on a graph, just for future reference, because sometimes we'll be talking about different graphs, and we're going to be talking about timing and rate of spikes. So when I am talking about spikes in the future, know that I'm talking about the cell's action potentials. Neurons generate APs by using sodium channels which respond to depolarization by becoming activated and opening. When sodium channels open, the relative permeability of the membrane to sodium increases, and the membrane potential moves closer to the equilibrium potential for sodium, causing the cell to depolarize even further. This activation continues to activate still more sodium channels, which also open and cause a further depolarization. With sufficient sodium channel activation, the membrane reaches a depolarization of about 15 millivolts, and the threshold is reached so that an action potential can be produced. The membrane fires an explosive all-or-none action potential down the axon, and as the impulse passes, repolarization begins to occur, allowing the membrane to return to resting potential. Action potentials tend to last a few milliseconds. The nerve cell membrane contains ion channels, and throughout this cell membrane, these ion channels are often voltage sensitive. Sometimes we refer to them as voltage gated, which contain pores that act as tunnels which permit specific ions to pass through the membrane. These channels possess a voltage sensor which responds to changes in the membrane potential, either activating them and allowing them to open or inactivating them and closing the channel pore. So we call these voltage gated or voltage sensitive because they sort of act like a gate, and they will only allow a specific type of ion to pass in or out of them depending on what voltage the cell membrane is at. The membrane of a neuron contains these voltage-sensitive sodium channels, which are selectively permeable to sodium when the membrane becomes depolarized. These channels open in response to that depolarization, and by opening them, they drive the membrane closer to equilibrium potential for sodium, further depolarizing the membrane, as I just described. And when the depolarization is sufficient to reach the neuron's threshold, it fires an action potential. We also have voltage-sensitive potassium channels, which will then open in response to the depolarization of the neuron and become selectively permeable to potassium ions. The membrane potential is driven back towards the equilibrium potential for potassium, which leads to hyperpolarization, and that's how the cell gets back to its resting potential. So basically what we're doing is we are trying to excite the axon of a neuron at a particular location enough that it starts this cascade of events where it opens a bunch of sodium channels and allows the influx of sodium, which causes the neuron to become greatly depolarized. And once it gets depolarized to a certain degree, potassium channels open and allow the outflux of potassium, which rapidly brings the membrane potential back to rest, although there is a slight refractory period. And so we've made a spike. It's gone up and then down. And this depolarization that has occurred in the axon is going to travel down the axon, thereby depolarizing each next segment that is adjacent. And then each segment that had just been depolarized will go through a slight refractory period and then back to rest. So we're sending a signal this way down the axon. In some neurons in the central nervous system via oligodendrocytes, and others in the peripheral nervous system via Schwann cells, have myelination. Non-myelinated axons in the CNS and the PNS generally have a smaller diameter of less than 1 micrometer in the PNS and less than 0.2 micrometers in the CNS. Because of the relatively uniform distribution of voltage-sensitive sodium and potassium channels, the action potential will travel along the axon in a continuous manner, and as the action potential flips the polarity of a given region of the axon, it continues to depolarize the region in front of it so that the impulse continues to move that direction. In non-myelinated axons, activation of sodium channels account for the depolarization of the action potential, and activation of potassium channels repolarize the cell. But what happens when we have myelination on the cell? Myelinated axons are covered by myelin sheaths that offer high electrical resistance and low capacitance, which mean they act as an insulator. This myelin sheath is periodically interrupted by small gaps of exposed axon, approximately 1 micrometer long. These gaps are called the nodes of Ranvier. So sodium and potassium channels are not uniformly distributed in these axons. Instead, sodium channels are densely clustered at the nodes of Ranvier and sparsely distributed in the internodal axon membrane. Potassium channels tend to be localized in the internodal and paranodal axon membrane that is covered by the axon. So in myelinated neurons, an AP performs what we call saltatory conduction, in which it jumps from one node of Ranvier to the next node of Ranvier. The energy requirement for saltatory conduction is much lower in myelinated fibers, so the metabolic cost of conduction is lower. Myelination results in an increased conduction velocity as a function of diameter. A myelinated neuron with a 10 micrometer diameter axon fires just as efficiently as an unmyelinated neuron with a 100 micrometer diameter axon. So this greatly reduces the time it takes for impulse travel, which is important for reflexes and muscle movement, as well as permitting the brain to make high-speed computations. So when discussing the conduction of action potentials, there are three types of nerve fibers according to diameter, conduction velocity, and physiological characteristic. There are A fibers, B fibers, and C fibers. A fibers are large and unmyelinated, they conduct rapidly, and carry various motor and sensory impulses. They are most susceptible to injury by mechanical pressure or lack of oxygen. B fibers are smaller, unmyelinated axons that conduct less rapidly than A fibers. These fibers serve autonomic functions. And C fibers are the smallest and are non-myelinated. They conduct impulses the slowest and serve pain conduction and autonomic functions. Sometimes there is an alternative classification for sensory axons in peripheral nerves, and I'll go over those now. Alternatively, there are four classifications, or four types, of neurons. There's type 1, which has two subtypes, A and B. So, of type 1, sub A, their origin is muscle spindle, an annulospiral ending, and their fiber type is A alpha. For number 1, sub B, you have the origin in the Golgi tendon organ, and their fiber type is also A sub alpha. For type 2, you have their origin in muscle spindle, flower spray ending, touch, and pressure. Their fiber type A beta. For type 3, you have their origin in pain and temperature receptors and some touch receptors, and their fiber type is A sigma. And in type 4, you have the origin in pain and other receptors, and their fiber type C. Let's talk about some of these main mammalian sensory neuron types, going by fiber type. So first we have fiber type A. Fiber type A has four subtypes, alpha, beta, gamma, and sigma. So we'll first talk about fiber type A, alpha, which functions in proprioception and somatic motor functions. The fiber diameter is anywhere between 12 and 20 micrometers. The conduction velocity is anywhere between 70 and 120 meters per second. And they have an unknown spike duration and an unknown absolute refractory period. Fiber type A beta function with touch and pressure, and their fiber diameter in micrometers is anywhere between 5 and 12. Their conduction velocity is anywhere between 30 and 70 meters per second. Their spike duration is anywhere between 0.4 and 0.5 milliseconds, and their absolute refractory period is anywhere between 0.4 and 1 milliseconds. Fiber type A gamma serves motor to muscle spindle function. It has a fiber diameter of approximately 3 to 6 micrometers. It has a conduction velocity of approximately 15 to 30 meters per second, and an unknown spike duration or absolute refractory period. Fiber type A sigma functions for pain, temperature, and touch sensitivity, has a fiber diameter of approximately 2 to 5 micrometers, a conduction velocity between 12 and 30 meters per second, and an unknown spike duration and absolute refractory period. Fiber type B serve preganglionic autonomic function. Their diameter is anywhere less than 3 micrometers. Their conduction velocity is between 3 and 15 meters per second. They have a spike duration of 1.2 milliseconds and an absolute refractory period of 1.2 milliseconds. And finally, we have fiber type C, of which we have the dorsal root and the sympathetic. So the dorsal root serves for pain and reflex responses, has a fiber diameter between 0.4 and 1.2 micrometers, a conduction velocity between 0.5 and 2 meters per second, a spike duration of 2 milliseconds, and an absolute refractory period of 2 milliseconds. And the sympathetic has a postganglionic sympathetic function with a fiber diameter between 0.3 and 1.3 millimeters, a conduction velocity between 0.7 and 2.3 meters per second, and a spike duration of 2 milliseconds and an absolute refractory period of 2 milliseconds. That was a lot of numbers. Hopefully for those who are interested, they will make sense to you. For those who are uninterested, you can pretty much disregard them. However, on rare occasion, I might bring up these specifics to explain important things in the future. Let's talk about synapses. A synapse is the gap or junction through which one neuron communicates with another neuron. Some synapses are excitatory, meaning they increase the likelihood that the postsynaptic neuron will fire. Other synapses are inhibitory, meaning they decrease the likelihood that the postsynaptic neuron will fire. Generally speaking, there are two broad anatomic classes of synapses: electrical or electronic synapses and chemical synapses. We've already talked about these a little bit, but we're going to cover them in more detail now. Electrical synapses are characterized by specialized structures called gap junctions, where the presynaptic and postsynaptic membranes meet. These gap junctions act as conductive pathways, allowing current to flow from the presynaptic axon to the postsynaptic neuron. These synapses do not require the use of neurotransmitters for transmission. Synaptic delay for electrical synapses is shorter than at chemical synapses. Electrical synapses occur only rarely in the mammalian central nervous system. As for chemical synapses, they account for the majority of synapses in the mammalian central nervous system. Chemical synapses have a distinct cleft of extracellular space that's about 30 micrometers wide, separating the presynaptic and the postsynaptic membranes. These neurons communicate at this junction using the diffusion of neurotransmitter molecules. When the presynaptic neuron is depolarized by an action potential, it releases neurotransmitter molecules across the synapse where they will bind to postsynaptic receptors. These receptors trigger the opening or closing of ligand-gated ion channels, which creates postsynaptic potentials. These depolarizations and hyperpolarizations are integrated by the neuron to determine whether it will fire. Presynaptic terminals hold membrane-bound presynaptic vesicles, which contain neurotransmitter. When an AP reaches the synaptic terminal, calcium, abbreviated Ca2+, to indicate that calcium molecules have a net positive 2 charge, channels open and trigger an influx. When an AP reaches the synaptic terminal, calcium channels open and trigger an influx of calcium into the presynaptic terminal. Calcium is abbreviated Ca2+, which indicates one calcium molecule has a net positive 2 charge. This increase in calcium promotes snare proteins to facilitate the fusion of the synaptic vesicles with the membrane. When these vesicles fuse with the membrane of the presynaptic neuron, they use exocytosis to release the neurotransmitter out into the synaptic cleft. Together, this release process and diffusion of neurotransmitter across the synaptic cleft account for what is called the synaptic delay, which lasts anywhere between 0.5 and 1 millisecond at a chemical synapse. Transmitter molecules carry information from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron by binding at the postsynaptic membrane with either of two types of postsynaptic receptor: a ligand-gated synaptic transmission, found exclusively in the nervous system, is directly linked to an ion channel. It is a chemical signal that binds directly to the postsynaptic ion channel and then is rapidly removed and is therefore termed as fast. This type of ion channel can be either excitatory or inhibitory. You also have second messenger-mediated synaptic transmission, like endocrine communication in non-neural cells, which uses receptors that are not directly linked to ion channels. Rather, these receptors are open or close. These receptors open or close ion channels or change intracellular second messenger levels by activating G proteins and producing second messengers, hence the name. Once transmitter is bound, the receptor interacts with the G protein molecule, which binds to guanosine triphosphate, or GTP, and becomes activated. The activation of G proteins leads to production of cyclic adenosine monophosphate, or cAMP. It also leads to the production of diacylglycerol, or DAG, and inositol triphosphate, abbreviated IP sub 3. cAMP, DAG, and IP sub 3 participate in the phosphorylation of ion channels, opening channels that are closed at resting potential, or closing channels that are open at resting potential. This process takes anywhere between hundreds of milliseconds to entire seconds to initiate and have effects that can last up to minutes. Thus, it is termed a slow process. G protein coupled receptors, or GPCRs, have been identified for a broad range of neurotransmitters, including dopamine, acetylcholine, or muscarinic acetylcholine receptors, and neuropeptides. Second messenger transmission may affect a wider range of postsynaptic neurons than ligand-gated ion channels and serve an important modulatory function. So we have both excitatory and inhibitory synaptic actions. Excitatory postsynaptic potentials, abbreviated EPSPs, are created when neurotransmitter molecules bind to receptors that either result in the opening of channels like sodium or calcium channels, or the closing of channels like potassium channels, all of which produce a depolarization. The reason that opening sodium or calcium channels produce a depolarization is because they will naturally try to go into the cell and make the internal cellular environment more positive. The reason that closing potassium channels creates a depolarization is because potassium naturally wants to leave the cell, and by closing that channel, it stays inside of the cell, leading to an overall depolarization. EPSPs tend to be axodendritic, meaning that the axon of the presynaptic neuron is communicating with the dendrite of the postsynaptic neuron. Inhibitory postsynaptic potentials, or abbreviated IPSPs, are caused by the opening of channels selective for chloride or potassium ions. The reason why opening channels that are selective for chloride or potassium ions leads to a hyperpolarization is because when you open a chloride channel, chloride naturally goes into the cell, making the internal cellular environment more negative, or when you open a potassium channel, it leads to the outflux of potassium, also thereby making the internal environment of the cell more negative. The processing of information by the postsynaptic neuron involves the integration of both of these EPSPs and IPSPs from many other neurons. If these signals occur closely in time, EPSPs, or the depolarizations, and IPSPs, or the hyperpolarizations, tend to sum up with each other. As the neuron integrates these signals, it weighs the excitatory and inhibitory signals together, and depending on whether the threshold is reached in the impulse initiation zone, which is usually the axon initial segment, an action potential is either generated or not. If the action potential is initiated, it propagates along the axon to send a signal to another neuron. The rate and the pattern of APs carry information. So now that we've gone over quite a bit about the neuron and its basic function and how neurons communicate with one another, we can get into some of the things that I tend to find more interesting. The first concept that we'll talk about is synaptic plasticity and long-term potentiation. Long-term potentiation is also abbreviated LTP. So this concept involves the idea that the nervous system can actually learn and store information in the form of memories. It is suspected that the basis of memory storage has to do with the strengthening of particular synaptic connections. This storage is called long-term potentiation, or LTP, and it's characterized by the enhanced transmission at synapses that follow high-frequency stimulation. LTP was first observed in the hippocampus, a part of the brain that plays an important role in memory, and likely plays a role in associative learning. LTP is dependent on the presence of N-methyl-D-aspartate, or NMDA, receptors in the postsynaptic membrane. These glutamate receptors open postsynaptic calcium channels in response to binding of the transmitter glutamate, but only if the postsynaptic membrane is depolarized. And we'll talk a little bit more about why this is. But depolarization of the postsynaptic neuron requires activation of other synapses, and the NMDA receptor-linked calcium channels open only when both sets of synapses are activated. These synapses sense the pairing of the two synaptic inputs, similar to conditioning to behavioral stimuli. As a result of increased calcium influx into the postsynaptic cells using NMDA receptors, protein kinases are activated and, through a series of actions, strengthen the synapse. Production of a second messenger by synaptic activity may also play a role in regulation of gene expression in the postsynaptic cell. Second messengers can activate enzymes that modify pre-existing proteins or include the expression of new proteins, a mechanism whereby the synaptic activation of the cell can induce long-term changes in that cell. These structural changes provide the basis for memory and provide an example of plasticity within the nervous system, plasticity being the brain's ability to change and adapt to reflect a new environment. Let's talk about presynaptic inhibition. Presynaptic inhibition is mediated by axoaxonal synapses, where an axon delivers information to the axon of another postsynaptic neuron. Binding of neurotransmitters to the receptors mediating presynaptic inhibition leads to a reduction in the amount of neurotransmitter secreted by the postsynaptic axon. This reduction is caused either by a decrease in the size of the action potential in the presynaptic terminal as a result of activation of potassium or chloride channels, or by reduced opening of calcium channels in the presynaptic terminal, thereby decreasing the amount of transmitter release. Presynaptic inhibition thus provides a mechanism whereby the gain at a particular synaptic input to a neuron can be reduced without reducing the efficacy of other synapses that impinge on that neuron. Next, I want to talk about the neuromuscular junction and the end plate potential. Lower motor neurons project through peripheral nerves to muscle cells. Their axons terminate at part of the muscle membrane called the motor end plate, which represents localized specialization of the membrane surrounding a striated muscle fiber called the sarcolemma. The neuromuscular junction is the location where the nerve impulse is transmitted to the muscle fiber. The end plate potential is the prolonged depolarizing potential that occurs at the end plate in response to AP activity in the motor axon. The neurotransmitter used at a neuromuscular synapse is acetylcholine, abbreviated ACH. At rest, acetylcholine are randomly released from the nerve cell membrane, producing a minute depolarization and a mini end plate potential of about 0.5 millivolts amplitude. These potentials are called quanta, and they reflect the random discharge of acetylcholine from a single synaptic vesicle. When an impulse reaches the myoneural junction, substantially more neurotransmitter is released as a result of the synchronous discharge of acetylcholine from many synaptic vesicles. This results in a full end plate potential that exceeds the firing level of the muscle fiber. So that was really our first time talking about a particular neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, and that kind of leads us into discussing neurotransmitters in general. So let me just talk a little bit about neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are the messengers at chemical synapses, and their action may be blocked by pharmacological agents. Some pharmacological agents block the reuptake of the transmitter, prolonging the action of the transmitter by keeping it from re-entering the presynaptic cell, which means that that transmitter is stuck in the cleft longer and has more time to be used by the postsynaptic membrane. Some presynaptic neurons release more than one type of neurotransmitter, and differences in the frequency of nerve stimulation probably controls which transmitter is being released. We will finish this segment discussing some of the most common neurotransmitters and their basic functions. The first one you heard me talk about a moment ago was acetylcholine, so we'll start with that one. Acetylcholine is synthesized in the presynaptic neuron by choline acetyltransferase. It is broken down in the synaptic cleft by acetylcholine esterase, abbreviated ACHase. Choline enzymes are synthesized in the cell body and carried down the axon to the synaptic terminal where it becomes acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is used at a variety of sites in both the PNS and the CNS. Acetylcholine is responsible for the transmission of excitatory impulses at neuromuscular junctions using N-type nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. This neurotransmitter is used in autonomic ganglia and released by preganglionic sympathetic and parasympathetic neurons. Postganglionic parasympathetic neurons and the fibers that innervate sweat glands use acetylcholine as their transmitter, specifically M-type muscarinic receptors. In the CNS, acetylcholine is used by several groups of neurons, including those that project widely from the basal forebrain nucleus of Meynert to the cerebral cortex and from the septal nucleus to the hippocampus. Cholinergic neurons in the brainstem tegmentum project to the hypothalamus and thalamus, where they use acetylcholine as a transmitter. A few interesting things about acetylcholine. The neurons that produce choline are often termed cholinergic because they create choline, and then that choline is modified to become acetylcholine. And acetylcholine esterase rapidly deteriorates acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft. And the reason for this is because you want to move specifically when you want to move, and you want to stop moving specifically when you want to stop moving. So it's very important that this molecule only works at the exact moment that you want it to in the neuromuscular junction, so that your muscles move precisely as you mean them to. And rather than reuptake the acetylcholine so that it can be recycled, it makes better sense to just remove it entirely because the process is a lot faster. Also, notice that the receptors that respond to acetylcholine are referred to as nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. And the reason that they are referred to as such is because they are also activated by nicotine, the addictive substance found in tobacco, for which they are named. Moving on, we'll talk about glutamate. Glutamate is an amino acid that has been identified as a major excitatory transmitter in the mammalian brain and spinal cord. Of the four types of postsynaptic glutamate receptors that have been identified, three of them are ionotropic, meaning that they are directly linked to ion channels. These receptors are named for the specific drugs that bind to them. The kainate and AMPA types of glutamate receptors, or AMPA, are linked to sodium channels and produce EPSPs when activated. The NMDA receptor is linked to a channel that is permeable to both calcium and sodium, but is blocked by a magnesium ion and cannot become activated unless the postsynaptic membrane is depolarized to release the magnesium first. This means that they can only mediate calcium influx when the activity at the synapse is paired with excitation from the depolarization of other synaptic inputs. This influx of calcium may lead to structural changes that strengthen the synapse, such as with long-term potentiation with learning and memory. Metabotropic glutamate receptors have also been identified, and their activation leads to the liberation of IP3 and DAG, causing an increase in intracellular calcium levels and altering function and structure. Excessive activation of these synapses can lead to very large influxes of calcium into the neuron and leading to cell death. Glutamate is excitatory, and its excessive release may lead to further excitation of neural circuits by positive feedback, which causes a damaging avalanche of depolarization and calcium influx into neurons. This mechanism is excitotoxic and may be important for understanding the neuronal degradation seen in stroke, central nervous system trauma, and degenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's. Next, we'll talk about catecholamines. The catecholamines, norepinephrine, otherwise known as noradrenaline, Epinephrine, otherwise known as adrenaline, and dopamine are all formed by hydroxylation and decarboxylation of the essential amino acid phenylalanine. Phenylethanolamine N-methyltransferase, the enzyme responsible for converting norepinephrine to epinephrine, is found in high concentration primarily in the adrenal medulla. Epinephrine is found at only a few sites in the central nervous system. Dopamine is synthesized via the intermediate molecule dehydroxyphenylalanine, or DOPA, D-O-P-A, from the amino acid tyrosine by tyrosine hydroxylase and DOPA decarboxylase. Norepinephrine, in turn, is produced by hydroxylation of dopamine. Dopamine, like norepinephrine, is activated by monoamine oxidase, abbreviated MAO, and catechol O-methyltransferase, abbreviated COMT. Let's start with talking about the catecholamine dopamine. Generally, dopaminergic neurons, or neurons that produce dopamine, have an inhibitory effect. Dopaminergic neurons originate in the substantia nigra, substantia meaning substance, and nigra meaning black, so the black substance, which is located in the basal ganglia, and project to the caudate nucleus and putamen through the nigrostriatal system. They also originate from the ventral tegmental area, or the VTA, to the limbic system and cortex through the mesolimbic and mesocortical projections. Parkinson's is a disease in which the dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra begin to degrade. The neurons projecting to the caudate nucleus and putamen are damaged, leading to the impairment of inhibitory processes. The neurons projecting to the limbic system and cortex may be involved in schizophrenia. Dopaminergic neurons have also been identified in the retina and olfactory systems, where they mediate inhibition that filters sensory input. Next, we'll talk about norepinephrine. Norepinephrine-containing neurons in the PNS originate in the sympathetic ganglia. From the sympathetic ganglia, these neurons project to all the postganglionic sympathetic neurons except those innervating sweat glands, which are innervated by axons that use acetylcholine as a transmitter. Norepinephrine-containing neurons in the CNS originate from two areas, the locus coeruleus and the lateral tegmental nuclei. The locus coeruleus is relatively small, containing only several hundred neurons, and projects widely throughout the cortex, hippocampus, thalamus, midbrain, cerebellum, pons, medulla, and spinal cord. Noradrenergic neurons in the lateral tegmental areas of the brainstem appear to have a complementary projection, projecting axons to regions of the central nervous system that are not innervated by the locus coeruleus. These projections from the locus coeruleus and the lateral tegmental area appear to play a modulatory role in the sleep-wake cycle and in cortical activation, and may also regulate sensitivity of sensory neurons. Some evidence suggests that abnormal paroxysmal activity in the locus coeruleus can result in panic attacks. Next, let's talk about the neurotransmitter serotonin. Serotonin, or 5-hydroxytryptamine, abbreviated 5-HT, is an important regulatory amine in the CNS. Serotonergic neurons are present in the raphe nuclei, in the pons and medulla. These cells are part of the reticular formation, and they project widely to the cortex and hippocampus, the basal ganglia, the thalamus, the cerebellum, and the spinal cord. 5-HT-containing neurons and norepinephrine-containing neurons both appear to play an important role in arousal. For example, firing levels in the raphe nuclei are correlated with sleep level, and their firing rate drops in response to REM sleep, or rapid eye movement sleep. 5-HT neurons may also modulate sensory input, primarily for pain. SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which increase serotonin availability by keeping it in the synaptic cleft, are used as antidepressants. Next, we'll talk about gamma-aminobutyric acid, abbreviated GABA, or GABA. GABA is present in relatively large amounts in the gray matter of the brain and spinal cord. GABA is inhibitory and likely mediates presynaptic inhibition. GABA is formed from L-glutamic acid by glutamic acid decarboxylase, or GAD, all of which occur in the CNS and the retina. There are two GABA receptors that have been identified, called GABA sub A and GABA sub B, or GABA A and GABA B. Although both mediate inhibitory processes, they do so by different ionic pathways. Inhibitory GABAergic interneurons are present in the cerebral cortex and cerebellum, as well as many other nuclei throughout the brain and spinal cord. Baclofen is an agonist drug to GABA B receptors, and its inhibitory actions may contribute to its efficacy as an antispasticity agent. Next, we'll talk about endorphins. Endorphins is a general term referring to some endogenous morphine-like substances, which bind to opiate receptors in the brain. Endorphins are polypeptides with opiate-like action and may function as synaptic transmitters or modulators. Endorphins appear to modulate the transmission of pain signals within sensory pathways. Next, we'll talk about enkephalins. Methionine enkephalin, or metenkephalin, and leucine enkephalin, or leuenkephalin, are two closely related polypeptides, or pentapeptides, that also bind to opiate receptors in the brain. The amino acid sequence of metenkephalin has been found in alpha endorphin and beta endorphin, and that of beta endorphin has been found in beta lipotropin, a polypeptide secreted by the anterior pituitary gland. I think that's enough information for today. Today we covered the basics of how neurons communicate with one another, including neurotransmitter function. And we even covered some of the most prevalent neurotransmitters and their basic functions. In the next episode, I'd like to cover the relationship between neuroanatomy and neurology, and how an understanding of neuroanatomy can help us with clinical diagnosis related to neuronal disorders. So I just want to thank everybody again for listening to this series. I hope you've enjoyed it so far. If you have any questions, please feel free to leave me a message in the Anchor app, or if you follow me on TikTok, you can use the Q&A feature